Between history classes and movies, you may have come to know a story Americans tell themselves, that we're a group of people bonded by our belief in common values like equality and freedom. But that wasn't always our story, even if it is now. Our next guest says in the fragile early days of the United States, there was a huge intellectual fight over what that story would be, and it threatened the stability and survival of the country. Colin Woodard is an award-winning author and journalist. He's currently the state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald and the Maine Sunday Telegram. He's written a bunch of books about American history, including his latest, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Colin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me again.
You write that no one really knew what this United States thing was in the early days. The one unifying factor was, well, we just kicked the British out. Can you talk about the confusion, though, once that started to fade away?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a previous book I wrote, American Nations, argued that we'd never been one America, but several Americas, because of the differences between the rival colonial projects on the eastern and southern rims of what's now the United States. You know, New England and the Dutch settled area around New York City and the Appalachian backcountry and the Chesapeake Tidewater and the Spanish Southwest never saw eye to eye because they had different ethnographic and religious and cultural and political characteristics. They were each trying to do separate things. And those fissures were deep in our country, and everyone was aware of them. And then suddenly they fought the successful rebellion against British rule, against a shared threat, and they found themselves in a something together, I guess a country, something called the United States. And no one was quite sure precisely what it was, even after a constitution had been created. And so this continued on all the way into the early 19th century. As late as the 1830s, people were still a bit unsure of it. You know, was it supposed to be a loose confederation like today's, you know, European Union of sovereign states? Was it supposed to be an alliance collected together, you know, to share, you know, foreign relations and national defense, but not too much else? Or was it supposed to be a like unified, strong nation state like the Germans were talking about building in Central Europe from all the different principalities and duchies and little empires and kingdoms they had there? And they needed an answer by the 1830s because the revolutionary generation, with their living memories of that sort of shared triumph of the War of Independence, was dying and fading from the scene, and New England had considered seceding during the War of 1812, and Appalachian settlers had considered doing so in the 1790s during the Whiskey Rebellion. It was sort of a national security crisis. So we needed a story as to if the United States was to be a country rather than sort of a alliance. What was its story? Where did it come from? What did we share as values, and where were we going, and how would we define what Americans were?
And you follow that story through the eyes of a bunch of thinkers who wrestled with that question. We'll just be able to meet one or two of them, I think, as we talk. It was messier than this, but a common theme emerges that lasts for a century into 1920 and beyond. One idea that we are united by common vision and values. Another idea that we are an ethnostate of some sort with white people at the top, even if the definition of who white people are changes through time. Can you lay out that tension for us?
Absolutely. In brief, starting in the 1830s, there were those two rival visions you just outlined. One that we were essentially the homeland or homelands of the, you know, allegedly superior Anglo-Saxon race, and that human equality was, you know, false, and that clearly only certain, you know, people from certain backgrounds were capable of self-government and all the things envisioned in the Declaration of Independence. And there was a counter view, what we might call a civic nationalism, that said, you know, we Americans may not share a history because our colonial, you know, groups had very different backgrounds. But we share a future. We share fealty to a set of ideals, those in the Declaration of Independence, about, you know, the innate, you know, equality of humans and their unalienable rights to, you know, liberty, the pursuit of happiness and self-government. And those things were in tension and fought over throughout the 1830s and 40s and 50s, and then genuinely and literally fought over in the Civil War. And that struggle continued through the course of the book, told through the people who fought it, all the way up to the point where there was, the first nationwide, you know, broad consensus as to which vision they liked. And the rather shocking thing is, it's the ethno-state sort of white supremacist vision that first triumphed in the 1910s and 1920s.
We're talking to Colin Woodard about his new book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Let's get to, let's spoil the end of your book a little bit, Colin. I think as I learned history as a kid in school, when it came to black people in particular and civil rights, there was slavery. That was bad. The Civil War ended. Slavery, there's some Reconstruction, something, something, Martin Luther King. And a lot happened in that something, something period. That was really disastrous for progress, especially for African Americans. Can you talk about that a little?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, in short, the one would have thought that that civic national vision, that when the Union won the war and won after Abraham Lincoln had, made the Gettysburg Address saying that this is what the war is about. It's about the fact that we have never achieved the ideals we set forth in the Declaration and that this is our chance to do it. And this is the great blood sacrifice of our nation to see if humans can really be self-governing and, live in that kind of equality. And then the Union won the war. And as is often said, the South kind of won the peace in that in the struggle over Reconstruction, the sort of Union occupation and effort to reform and get the South to sort of join the Federation on those grounds. Eventually, the North sort of gave up and agreed and reconciled with the South on the terms of sort of white reconciliation, that we'll all agree that we all fought with honor, we'll forget about the fact that the war was about these broader moral issues, and we'll have a consensus to allow the country to reconcile and move forward by betraying the promise made to African Americans and allowing the former Confederate states to roll back in a reign of terror by the Ku Klux Klan, African American participation in politics and ability to actually serve in public office. You know, as soon as the Union troops withdrew, that's what happened. And it was an event that would be actually celebrated in textbooks and popular film, including the first great blockbuster movie in the United States, The Birth of a Nation, which was helped along by President Woodrow Wilson, in part because his close friend and fellow Deep Southerner, Thomas Dixon Jr., had written the novel upon which it was based. So these things were all drawn together, and it was not a good moment in period to look back on in United States history and the story of our nationhood.
We're talking to Colin Woodard about his latest book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What story did you learn growing up about the United States and who we are as a country? What do you see, if anything, uniting people as one common citizen of the United States? Or do you see more differences and divisions than things that unify us? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Colin Woodard about his new book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's important for a country, for our country, to have one unifying idea about who we are as a people? Do you think this country has lived up to ideals like equality and freedom for its citizens? What questions do you have for our guest about this idea of coming up with a national identity? Call in at 800-642-1234. Colin, I want to focus in on one thinker with a very strong Wisconsin connection. and I think I'm guessing a kindred spirit for you based on what he wrote and some of what you've written in the past, Frederick Jackson Turner.
I was hoping you'd ask about him because, yes, Frederick Jackson Turner had an enormous influence on the way Americans thought of themselves. He comes later in my story towards the second half of the 19th and the early 20th century when he was kind of at his peak of his involvement in the story. But he was born in Portage and he attended the University of Wisconsin in Madison and became a professor there and saw things from a Midwestern or what they called then a Western perspective. And it was his belief that what made Americans Americans was essentially the experience of coming into the Midwest and when settlers crossed the Appalachian Mountains and into what he considered this sort of, Eden, that they were no longer contaminated in their experiences by all the baggage of the old world with its, leftover, legacies of feudalism and all of its history, that they instead could return to be new people. And lo and behold, that experience made them good Democrats and Republicans and Americans, that you would be self-government and creating institutions yourselves and acting in a leveling spirit and being skeptical of aristocracy would all come naturally to the people living on the frontier. And that's what made us who we are. But the rather remarkable thing is, although he articulated this in a famous essay, this frontier thesis, and this thesis would sort of go viral, as it were, and spread almost all over the intellectual landscape and get incorporated into popular culture and later, you know, movies and into textbooks and to the way history of America was taught in universities and elsewhere. He himself quickly discovers, he dove into his research at the Wisconsin State Historical Society and at the archives of Madison and elsewhere, that the actual data didn't support this thesis. That as he looked at it closely, as the different peoples came into what we now consider the Midwest and the West, they didn't assimilate. You know, he was kind of looking at Darwinian principles, that the environment would shape organisms and organisms would adapt to their new environment, and that all these settlers would adapt and become good Midwesterners and therefore Americans. Instead, he found that the different settlement streams, the one coming with its origins in New England and settling the upper tiers, the upper Great Lakes states, and the one coming with its origins in Pennsylvania, settling the upper parts of the lower Great Lakes states, and the one out of Appalachia that was settling the lower tiers of Ohio and Illinois and Indiana and so on, that these settlers had these stubbornly different and distinct political behaviors and ideals that didn't seem to be dissolving in this new environment. And he spent he was a great thinker and a teacher and a researcher, but he was a real procrastinator as a writer. He spent the rest of his life, decades, putting together his magnum opus about the importance of these different sections, which I think was getting at a truism about the country that was missing from the stage. But unfortunately for him, nobody wanted to hear it. He was like a rock star who early in his career has a number one hit single, and then when he goes out later and tries to go play before concerts, everyone wants to hear his hit song and no one will hear the new stuff. He tried to get attention for it, but people would only give him a polite level of interest. So his frontier thesis, carried on and had a powerful influence for a half century over academia and scholarship and the way ordinary people thought about their country, and in a way still does, even if its author had himself started to feel that it probably wasn't correct at all.
Let's go to our callers now. Greg is on the line in Green Bay. Greg, hello.
Hello, thank you for having me. I have a comment in regards to the question you posed of unity or division in our country, and to the guest point with the propaganda movie from the early 1910s, Birth of a Nation, long before that and to this day, there are scare tactics used to make sure that unity does not happen. I do not believe that the greed and the power at the top could handle this nation unified in humanity against what they've spent the last 150 200 years building, and that is a power structure that is able to survive solely on the fact of based on fear.
Greg, I'm going to jump in because we don't have a lot of time left. I want to bring Colin in. Colin, what do you think of what Greg had to say?
I mean, in the early 19th century, when there was this battle between these two rival ideas, this ethno-national definition, the civic national one, the power bases were especially in different regions of the country. There was plenty of cross-regional support, but there was sort of a battle that reflected and echoed the Civil War between the interests of a plantation South and the emphasis that it placed on inequality, which was necessary if you were going to run a society based on a race-based slave system. You had to deny the things that were said in the Declaration of Independence, and that of the North, which didn't have, you know, if you were to see it cynically in economic or market terms, the North did not have the same incentives as an industrializing place to follow in that thing. So, you know, if what the caller is saying, this hypothesis, were to be true, at least for a long period while it was developing, it would have been at least bifurcated into competing, you know, narratives and structures and stuff between competing powerful people. And, you know, that would be a whole different and interesting discussion to have as to the degree to which that may have affected things. But definitely there was not one monolithic, interest group pushing it, because these two theories of American nationhood were so opposed to one another and incompatible.
Thanks for that call. In our last minute, Colin, this idea of the ethno-state controlling America reached its pinnacle in some ways, as you describe, in about 1920, about 100 years ago. Are we still having this conversation, this debate today in 2020?
I mean, it is. These things go back deep into our history. And, you know, I think people now are wondering what does hold us together as a nation. We have red states and blue, MAGA and Black Lives Matter, fundamental disagreements over values, over who's really American, over monuments and flags and symbols from our past. And, you know, these disagreements have now, right now, spilled out into the streets. So this is absolutely a poignant moment where these things are on the table and being discussed again. And a lot of the tension is between these two heritages. And, you know, it presents our federation, our country, and Americans with an opportunity that we should seize hold of to try to redefine what our shared values are and what holds us together, which, you know, I think is best done with being informed as to what held us together, you know, good and bad in the past, to draw the ingredients to hopefully come up with a meaningful and more satisfying and uniting story that we can all, agree upon to move forward so that the United States, you know, can survive in the longer term.
Colin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Colin Woodard, award-winning author and journalist. He was with us today to talk about his latest of many books about American history. The new one is called Union: The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood.